This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Books to kids, which people don't even know. I mean, Dolly for president, people.
He is a national.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at FordhamInstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Karen Bates. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, great to have you with us, Karen. And also joining us, as always, my co-host, David Griffith.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
Now, Karen, we are having you on the show because you have been one of the leaders of the back to school movement in New York City and nationally. And we want to talk about that. But of course, we know you from your day job, various day jobs over the years, but working in the curriculum space. Tell us a little bit about first your education wonk day job before we get into your education advocacy sideshow.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Of all the disappointing things of the 2020 evolution, one of the biggest ones is that I'm not probably spending enough of my day shouting about the literacy advocacy work that's kind of a chosen path for me. I spent a couple of years as a chief marketing officer at different organizations in K-12 that I thought were doing God's work, bringing some product to market that was going to be really helpful to schools and to teachers. And the last one was actually the Open Up Resources curriculum product. You know, while I was at Open Up Resources and at a couple different nonprofits I've worked with, including Student Achievement Partners, I've had this aha moment that many of us have had in the space that we do know how kids learn to read. We have decades of evidence at this point, and the districts that are aligning to that evidence have these really remarkable outcomes. But unfortunately, for a lot of systemic reasons, most educators don't actually know that research. And as soon as you know that, for me, I couldn't unknow that. So much of the work that I do is working with leading nonprofits and trying to advance the cause of greater educator awareness of that research. And it's actually not a bad segue to how I became the accidental frustrated mom about school reopening. Last spring, when schools closed, I knew too much. I started more stressed than the average human about the effect of last spring. And it was by reading like crazy, which was the only way I knew how to deal with my concerns, that I probably figured out before the average American even that we were in a position to open schools. And then last summer happened and we didn't. And the rest is probably the topic of our conversation.
Yeah. Tell me if this is right. You're in New York City.
I am New York City. I have a daughter who has been in a New York City public school. Yeah. She's in third grade now.
Yeah. So in New York City, of course, one of the only big city districts that actually seem to try to open their schools, at least earlier in the school year. Finally, we see around the country, many more coming on board slowly. So Karen, tell us your take on all of this as you have watched it play out in New York and elsewhere. And as you've been a participant in the debate, what's going on? Why is it that American schools, you know, still so many are not open in person, whereas in most of the rest of the world, we see kids in school learning?
I would be lying if I said I felt like I could explain why. It still feels so completely irrational to me that we couldn't, as Americans, center the same evidence that Europe centered. But I'll share a few reflections about some of the chapters of all of this. I suppose around June, that's probably when I started to have those aha moments that, okay, everyone's looking at the evidence here and we're watching COVID rates go down in New York. No system looks poised to reopen for this school year, but let's start thinking forward. Conversely, Europe did start opening some schools. So I was watching what happened in the European systems. I was hearing about what happened in the New York City rec centers where, unbeknownst to many because the media barely covered it, 100 schools stayed open for the children of essential workers. So there too, we had this really nice evidence base. Anya Kamenetz at NPR reported on it and told a national story about those centers and also a bunch in other cities that stayed open and didn't have an issue with COVID spread. And then we started to have other really decent studies, an Icelandic genomic study and other persuasive things saying to us, okay, wait, kids are not the locus of spread here. So I feel as of last summer that we had enough evidence to do what Europe did, and Europe was busy centering all that evidence. I spent a lot of time frustrated with the media during that chapter because it felt like we couldn't even hear those stories for all of the scaremongering stories that did bubble up. Because of my literacy-related work in Tennessee, I had traveled to a lot of the Tennessee districts that did go ahead with normal reopening. So during that summer and early fall chapter, I felt like I was kind of like a puppy dog. I kept tweeting at reporters like, have you seen this? look at this Tennessee school that's open. They've been open 9 weeks, no sign of COVID spread. And I really thought that the media would jump on this with me and that everyone was looking for reasons to open schools. I still remain shocked that that evidence was incredibly poorly centered until around October. In October, we had a wave of pretty decent coverage that started to say, okay, domestically and internationally, we're starting to have a good evidence base. And then began what was a really long protracted struggle that has continued into this winter, where some systems have managed to get it together and act on that evidence. A lot of systems haven't. I'm happy to be here at a moment where we can say that a plurality of districts do have schools open 5 days. That's new as of the last 2 weeks. We have more and more districts announcing that they're doing full reopenings every day. Newton, Massachusetts announced yesterday that they're going to go with 3-foot distancing. But we're also at a moment where some really flawed CDC guidance has unfortunately basically set up so that those districts that have a problem with their unions, where they just can't make it happen and they have deeply entrenched union resistance, the CDC guidance is so flawed that it's the bad parts of it are being used as evidence that districts can't open. So it's a mess.
So let's talk about that and some of the politics here, right? I mean, so part of this chapter that happened in the summer, I think you would agree, was Trump and DeVos, that when they came out hard for reopening, it may have actually hurt the cause in some blue states and blue districts, right? That there was a stiffening of the spines that you might have seen in some places in terms of the teacher unions, that perhaps that's maybe why you saw some of the media response, you know, that they've been so adversarial to, they had been so adversarial to Trump and DeVos on so many different fronts that, well, if they're calling for back to school, even in places where there may be a spike in the rates in the community, that may have actually hurt the cause. Then you fast forward and now we've got a new president, and President Biden comes in. He has promised to open a majority of schools within the first 100 days and is doing a lot of work on the vaccine front and seemed to think that his CDC guidance was going to be helpful to the cause. And then lo and behold, the guidance comes out and now a lot of places are saying, no, actually the guidance has hurt. That if you take the guidance seriously, only something like 4% of the schools should even be open right now. Because of the rates of infection out there. So what do you think is going on with the Biden administration?
Again, an area that parent advocates and school reopening advocates are sitting there scratching their heads. I've even heard that there are entire state education departments, Massachusetts notoriously, that expected the CDC guidance to come out and say, we bless 3-foot distancing now. Mm. If there's one thing we would want to undo about the CDC guidance, it is distancing, because as long as they insist on 6-foot distancing, the die is cast where you can't reopen full-time 5 days in many schools.
Although, Karen, it does say in that CDC report, where feasible, right? It says 6 feet where feasible. Yeah. It's a little wiggle room, right?
I hear that. And it's, you know.
You should be tweeting that every day. Just those words. Because I didn't know that.
I can do that. You don't even have Twitter, David. Come on.
I know, but I appreciate
it. You should be tweeting it every day. But here's the thing. I've tweeted every day. So many people have come out about the distancing, right? So you have J.G. Allen, who is at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's about as respected in this space as you get in terms of thinking about what does it mean. He chairs the Safe Building Commission for the Lancet for COVID. He has, Ben Linus. We have many of these powerful voices who have come forward to say, Europe has run with 3 feet. 3 to 6 is what the American Academy of Pediatrics has said. So there's enough other evidence that if you're a leader in a district and you want to go with something else, you could point to a pile of evidence that say 3 foot's just fine. But the problem is, if you're in a district where your union is just plain entrenched and they're not going to move come hell or high water, and or you're not a particularly strong leader as a superintendent, you have something you can hold up to say, what they really want me to do is 6 feet. And so that's why the CDC evidence, it absolutely gave enough room for someone to do something other than what it's saying. But then why didn't it just say something other than what it's saying? Why not say 3 to 6 feet?
That's fair. Although the flip side is, if the unions that don't want to go back, they're going to find an excuse no matter what, right? And the question is, what should political leaders do about that? And we've talked about that a bunch here on the show. I mean, I look out in California, poor Gavin Newsom, whoever he seems to hate because he went out for one dinner. He shouldn't have done the dinner. That was dumb. But, you know, he's put, I think the latest is $6 billion in state money on the table. I think it's state money, maybe it's partly federal, but, you know, to get things reopened, to vaccinate teachers, to get everything going. And the LA Teachers Union not only dismissed it, they said that his plan amounted to structural racism, I think the word was, because somehow it was written by rich people and it wasn't paying attention to the devastation this pandemic has caused to communities of color. And you say, we all are aware of that. We're also aware of the fact that this learning loss is causing devastation in communities of color. And everybody agrees, we're not going to force kids to go back to school right now if the families don't want them there, right? It's about having a choice. And you would think that anywhere in the country, any decent district should be able to figure out how to protect teachers who still are not vaccinated and are at risk. If you've got some teachers or who have family members at risk, we certainly still need teachers to be teaching remotely. If we've got all these kids learning remotely, you could figure that out, right? But you've also got tens of thousands of teachers in their 20s and 30s who are healthy and don't have risk factors who could be in their teaching right now. So this is what's so tricky, is that it does feel like the unions hold all the cards. And, you know, any attempts at really using leverage against them has backfired, as far as I can tell, you know, which is why we're, you know, my argument of all Biden and probably all a governor in a blue state can do is gently cajole and nudge and bring them along, because if they get their spines stiffened, you're dead, you're done. But here's my big question, Karen.
Yes.
Is the fall. I think the three of us would agree that we should see every school in America open full time in person this fall. Yeah. Unless there's something really weird happens with the variants, right? But hopefully by then, the pandemic's behind us or the rates are super low. Every adult that wants a vaccine has gotten the vaccine. Teenagers, there's probably starting to be vaccines for teenagers. Do you think we're going to see schools open full time?
I think we've seen districts more or less separate themselves into three cohorts. And there's the cohort that ran with opening and got to full opening by mid-fall. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the data from Burbio tells you that those districts, even that group, sometimes went dark a little bit during the holidays when COVID was spiking and due to holidays. But that group, I'm going to call them the committed openers, right?
Yep.
Your Florida's, your Texas, Tennessee.
Yep.
And then you've got this group in the middle that I feel like they're the transitional group. And they opened hybrid. Many of them, you know, Newton, Mass, opened hybrid, now moving to 5 days. Opened hybrid and now moving to 5 days is almost the most common cohort. And then you've got the urbans with a union problem. And I think that come fall, the openers are going to be openers. The folks that are in the middle will be following the evidence, will have vaccinated communities. And I'm bullish on that middle cohort to open full 5 days. Maybe some of them hold back their high school kids, but I think they run with opening. But I'm really worried about the urban districts. And, you know, sitting in New York is already saber rattling about the need to distance because kids won't be vaccinated in the fall already. It's March. And we've clearly seen signals from a number of California districts and also districts in Oregon that they believe that they shouldn't reopen until children have been vaccinated. Friends, we don't even have vaccines in trials yet for children. Yep. That last cohort is still a big problem. And it's why I want to take a second and answer the question that you asked before, but I didn't quite get to it. You know, what needs to happen now? A lot of the answer is, I don't know. I mean, this is a mess. So there's a lot that needs to happen. And you hung Trump and DeVos, and I think that they get a lot of the blame for what happened last summer and fall. But we also have to talk about leadership at a state level and leadership at a district level.
Yeah.
Good reporting has shown us Gina Raimondo, a Democrat in Rhode Island, sitting right next to Massachusetts with some really strong unions, said, we are opening schools, and she got it done.
Yep.
As of mid-March, every district there is open. So it's not as partisan as it looks. It's really a leadership issue. And I think we need states to be stepping up the way that they are. But parents are starting to conclude that we need to act differently. You're seeing political action committees forming. Pennsylvania, there's a political action committee. New York Moms just announced one this week. Parents are concluding that political action committees and lawsuits are actually the only forcing function in that last cohort just showing up and advocating and protesting didn't get it done.
That is really powerful. And this is one of the big questions, you know, does this actually change the power dynamics in education reform going forward? I've been a little skeptical, but look, if you start getting some parents running for school board in these big districts and actually winning some races or certainly the lawsuit option, that could change the equation. Well, hey, Karen, super helpful. Thank you for everything you're doing to help get kids back in school and back learning again. And appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, Karen Vates. All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Did you see the latest from Dolly Parton?
I didn't, but I love Dolly Parton. Oh, she didn't want to be made a statue, right?
That was like 2 weeks ago in Dolly Parton is Awesome. The latest in Dolly Parton is Awesome is that she got her first vaccine of the Moderna vaccine, which she had helped to fund. I remember this, that she had given $1 million to Vanderbilt Center that was involved in the research behind it. Nice. And then she said, she quipped that she got a dose of her own medicine.
Oh, man.
Yet she still finds time to write all my children's books.
And she gives away books to kids, which people don't even know. I mean, I know. Dolly for president, people.
She is a national treasure, I tell you.
Yes.
Well, Amber, what do you have for us this week?
We have a new working paper out in the AFP Journal. Love this journal. By Harvard and Boston University scholars. They're looking at how both the pipeline and admission process for Boston's three exam schools affect racial diversity in the schools and racial gaps in enrollment. It's a timely study, I think, because these exam schools are, you know, under a lot of pressure and scrutiny for their admission policies and how they affect diversity in those schools. So it's kind of a deep dive into Boston's three exam schools that serve grades 7 through 12 students. They together enrolled 25% of Boston public school students in the eligible grades. Nearly three quarters of BPS students are Black or Hispanic, but they comprise under 40% of overall exam school enrollment and only 20% at Boston Latin School, which is considered the most selective and prestigious of the three exam schools. During the study period, they track kids through the exam school admissions pipeline to determine which aspects of the admission process may be contributing most to the racial gaps in enrollment. So they're looking at six stages of the pipeline: test taking, the scores themselves, GPAs, the exam school preferences by the kids, exam school invitations, and ultimate enrollment in the schools. At the time, the schools required that students take the Independent School Entrance Exam, or ISSE, in the fall of sixth grade and also rank the three schools in order of their enrollment preferences. Admission was based on an equally weighted average of students' fifth and sixth grade, I'm going to call it ISSE score, and their GPA. I'd actually never heard of this independent entrance exam, but it's apparently fairly popular. But it's not necessarily aligned to the MCAS standards, which is another thing we can talk about. Anyhow, analysts examined the BPS fifth grade classes of 2006-07 through 2012-13. Just a quick little note more about the methods. For demographics for poverty, since over 95% of the BPS kids are listed as free and reduced lunch recipients, they use a zip code-based measure that basically indicates whether the student lives in a zip code with an average income in the bottom 50% of the sample. They run multiple models. They find that the one that includes MCAS scores as a primary control and cohort fixed effects is the most stable and preferred. Key finding, descriptively, they find that although Black and Hispanic students comprise nearly 80% of BPS fifth graders, they're less than half as likely as their white counterparts to take the qualifying test, and less than a quarter as likely to be invited to enroll at one of the exam schools in seventh grade. However, across all subgroups, acceptance rates among invited students are similar, exceeding 80%. So if they get the acceptance, they're taking it. And Black and Hispanic students are as likely to remain enrolled as well through 12th grade, just as their white and Asian peers. Backing up a little bit, the large gaps in enrollment are driven in part by the large racial gaps in baseline academic achievement. Black and Hispanic BPS fifth graders score on average at the 43rd to 45th percentile of the BPS distribution on the MCAS exam, while white and Asian students score about 20 to 30 percentiles higher. But again, the gaps are also due to differences in test-taking rates, as even among those kids with similar top quartile MCAS scores, Black and Hispanic students are roughly 20 percentage points less likely than their white peers to take the ISSE. And when those kids do test, they score 10 percentile points lower than their white peers. The score gap, however, significantly narrows, as do the differences in the GPAs, although it doesn't disappear when they look at high achievers from the same elementary schools. They also find that Black and Hispanic test takers are less likely to put Boston Latin down as their first choice. They don't exactly know why. The cumulative effects of these differences throughout the pipeline is that Black and Hispanic kids are less likely to be invited to an exam school. And then they do a neat thing. They try to simulate a bunch of different scenarios about how these racial diversity gaps might be addressed. And they find that the most promising would be to use an MCAS-based admissions by school procedure. So in other words, invite the top 17% of fifth graders at each BPS school to attend the exam schools in seventh grade, with the top 7% receiving invitations to Boston Latin. This method increased Black and Hispanic representation among invited students overall from 38 to 49%, and among those invited to Boston Latin from 21 to 38%. And then finally, in a little PS to the study, we find out that in light of COVID, exam invitations will now be based on some combination of GPA and residential zip code, because of tests are obviously don't know what's going on. How this new procedure is going to last, we're not sure. That's a lot, but there you have it.
Well, whether it will last may depend on whether it gets past a new lawsuit that was just filed against it as well, is my understanding.
Right.
You know, with parents, I think mostly white and Asian parents, worried about how this new plan is going to play out. The MCAS thing certainly seems like a no-brainer, though, right? I mean, they'd save money, and it results at least in marginally more diverse classes. So,
right.
You know, why not, right?
Right.
I know that was like a real question.
No, I mean, I'm trying to find the downside myself.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I wonder if the gifted education people or the schools themselves think there's something about this other exam that does a better job getting at the kind of qualities that they're most interested in. But, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. Especially since I wasn't familiar with that exam. And then, you know, they also had the issue of the alignment that I did mention.
Yeah.
And they'd already fixed some issues with, you know, kids having to come on Saturdays. You know, they thought that that was an issue too with the take up of the test. And so they changed that to make it easier for kids to be able to take the test. So,
You know, this notion of admitting kids by school or zip code, I mean, it's something that we have really wrestled with at Fordham. You know, we certainly have said in the past that when it comes to gifted programming, absolutely, we should use so-called local norms, where you say, okay, take the 5 or 10% top kids and give them a special gifted education program. But when you talk about these exam schools, you know, then you're talking about something very different, because if you start to admit kids who are all relatively low achieving because they're in schools where everybody is very low achieving, and then throw them in with kids who are very high achieving, you know, is that going to really work? I don't know. I'm nervous about it. And it's interesting what you said, Amber, about how the score gap was narrow at if you look at kids from the same elementary school, in other words, the racial achievement gap. One way to read that is that you may have had some schools where, let's say, everybody's upper middle class, but there's some racial diversity. So it includes that there's some African-American upper middle class kids or Hispanic upper middle
right.
class kids. And those are kids who are scoring higher and getting into these schools. And those are the kids of color who are most likely perhaps to do well at those schools. If you go to a zip code based system, suddenly those kids of color may be the ones that no longer get in. Right? You kind of replace those kids with poorer kids of color who may be also lower achieving kids of color. Anyways, oh my God, it's so complicated, right? It's like, what do we care most about? Is it racial diversity? Is it socioeconomic right. diversity? Or is it just the notion that these schools should be schools where the kids with the highest academic potential get to go?
Yes, end
story. Right.
So Amber, I may have missed it. What, is there a proportion of kids who get invited who do not go? In other words, how many kids sort of have the opportunity to go and do not go?
Don't know. I just did know the thing that I did bring up is the uptake is similar across racial groups. So whatever it is, it's they didn't see a big difference in the acceptance rates.
Right. I mean, it is a little weird to say out loud, right? But if you could invite fewer kids, or invite more kids, depending on the group. If anything, we should be fighting more kids from these underrepresented communities, not less, is probably the best way to put it. But I guess it's weird to say that we should invite fewer white kids. So
look, the other thing that we need to say is the problem here is scarcity. Let's build more schools. Let's have Boston Latin number two. You know, that is where the real struggle is. If there are more kids out there who are ready to do this kind of high level work and have this dude succeed in these kinds of programs, let's build more of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy talk.
No, and look, I mean, it does seem like this study was something that had a real world impact, or at least there's some relationship between what they found and what Boston seems to be.
Yeah. Having. I mean, I think although, we didn't even touch on, you know, how do we you know, are there different types of gifted and different types of talents? You know, I know there's a big contingent of the quote gifted ed community that thinks it's not all about test scores, right? There are different ways to identify giftedness. So we didn't even get to that, but yes, complicated.
All right. But we can't get to everything because that is all the time that we have for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrillo at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.